This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. U.S. President Donald Trump has been loudly criticizing the Iran nuclear deal since his days on the campaign trail. Last Friday, he decertified the deal to the condemnation of Iran and nations all over the world and many political voices in America as well. We'll talk with Trumpet writer Anthony Chibatterway to discuss why he did this and the effects that his decision might have in light of biblical prophecy. Another stunning election in Europe, this time in Austria. Sebastian Kurz is a suave 31-year-old, and he's going to be the next leader of Austria after his party received the most votes in elections this past weekend. It's quite a remarkable result that has several interesting ramifications. You'll definitely want to hear our interview with Trumpet writer Richard Palmer on this subject. California is experiencing the deadliest wildfires in its history, and this at the end of a terrible year of disasters for the state, as well as disasters around the country. We'll talk with Trumpet writer Sam Livingston about what is happening here, and we'll get to the causes that you won't hear from any other news source. And finally, I'll give you three reasons why it's important to build more passion in your life. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. When the Obama administration made the nuclear deal with Iran in 2015, Congress passed an act requiring the president to certify Iran's compliance with the deal every 90 days. President Donald Trump has done that twice so far in his presidency, but last Friday he said no, he would not certify that Iran was complying with the deal. He didn't withdraw from the deal, but he made it possible for Congress to toughen the terms of the deal. They have 3 months now to rework it. Iran, of course, denounced this move, and so did many other nations who said that the deal can't be renegotiated. To talk about this, we have Trumpet writer Anthony Chibatterway. Hello, Anthony.
Hello, Mr. Hilliker.
So, first of all, Donald Trump is right, is he not, that Iran is not complying with the deal? This is provable.
That's a very good question. Well, proponents of the Iran nuclear deal will tell you that Iran has been complying with the deal. They will tell you that, hey, President Trump, like you said, twice in April and in July, he certified that Iran was complying with the deal. And they will also tell you that the IAEA, that's the International Atomic Energy Agency, has certified Iran Iranian compliance 8 times now. So they will tell you all of these things. But yes, to answer your question, President Trump is indeed right in saying that this time around, Iran is not complying with the deal. And even when he did certify Iranian compliance in April and in July, he did say that Iran was breaking the spirit of the deal. But really, Iran has been breaking both the spirit of the nuclear deal and the letter of the nuclear deal. The deal requires that Iran give international inspectors unfettered access to nuclear and military facilities, and Iran has only provided partial access to those sites. There's one particular site in Iran. It's the Bachin military site. And the IAEA suspects that it's associated with Iran's nuclear program, and Iran is not granted access to this site. In fact, the IAEA has not even asked to inspect that site. And David Albright, he's a former IAEA inspector, he said that the IAEA has not asked for access to this site and other Iranian military sites because it fears it'll bring down the nuclear deal. So that's breaking the deal right there. But there's more. Iran has exceeded the agreement's limits on heavy water production. Now, heavy water is used to cool down the reactors used in producing nuclear material. And proponents of the deal will tell you that Well, Iran only exceeded this limit just slightly. In fact, some analysts say that Iran simply misinterpreted the language in the deal. The language that explained these limits, they say that Iran thought that the limit was just an estimate, believe it or not. They say that, well, Iran just misunderstood the language, thought that it was just an estimate and not a hard cap on production. But they will say, they will tell you that, well, that misunderstanding has been clarified, and now Iran is not violating the nuclear deal. Everything has been taken care of. But that's not all. Iran has also exceeded the agreement's limits on advanced centrifuges that are used to make weapons-grade plutonium or uranium. Now, as crazy as it sounds, proponents of the deal could tell you that, well, Iran really didn't exceed those limits. And you know why? It's because the extra centrifuges broke. So conveniently, Iran was in compliance of the deal by accident. So this is what we are faced with. Iran has continued acquiring banned nuclear material, and it's working on its missiles program, contravening UN resolutions in doing so.
It has not the nuclear deal, but other resolutions.
Yes, other resolutions aside from the nuclear deal. So I suppose that's where Mr. Trump is saying that it's breaking the spirit of the law, the spirit of the nuclear deal. It continues sponsoring terrorism. In fact, last week, when President Trump announced his decisions, he started off by just giving an assessment of Iran's history in supporting terrorism and in destabilizing the whole world, really. And this is, everyone agrees on this. He talked about Iran's history back when the regime was started in 1979 after the Iranian Revolution, just reminding Americans of the danger that Iran poses to Americans and, of course, to the world as well. But he reminded us of the hostage crisis in Iran, Iran sponsoring Hezbollah, which then bombed the U.S. embassy twice in Lebanon in 1983 and in 1984. And in 1984, that's when the United States designated Iran as a state sponsoring nation. And he went on to give an account of Iran's activities in embassies in Kenya, in Tanzania, and its involvement in 9/11, harboring terrorists that were involved in the attacks.
Yeah, there's plenty of evidence to show what Iran is really about. I mean, just as you're detailing all of these material contraventions of the deal that Iran has patently made, you just wonder why there is such a determination on the part of so many nations to look the other way and to pretend like Iran is in compliance, and why when an American president comes out and says, well, wait a minute, let's talk about reality here, that there would be so much opposition to that.
Well, I think that's probably the most important part that we all need to know and understand better, because these are two opposite arguments, and really they are a matter of life and death, really, because everyone, for the most part, everyone agrees and understands that Iran poses a serious danger to the whole world. Even people who support the deal, they will tell you that we want to stop Iran from developing nuclear weapons, and we think that after 12 years, this is the best we can come up with. Mm-hmm. We don't want anything to disrupt that. As flawed as it is, I think, in a sense, you could say that Iran is already holding the world hostage, because
this is kind of like the worst of all of the bad options, according to the way the world is reasoning.
Yes, and the world is just afraid that Iran, if it gets disappointed, it'll just go back to what it has been doing before the nuclear deal, which was just doing whatever it wanted without any consequences, well, without any military consequences or any fear of military consequences. People might remember Iran's former president, Ahmadinejad. He was so blatant in telling the world what Iran is up to. But because of the nuclear deal, Iran changed its stance, but really changed its stance in terms of the way it appeared, the way it wanted to appear towards to the leaders of the world.
But not the substance.
Not the substance. So I guess some people think that that was a positive move. Iran is changing, but we know that Iran hasn't changed a bit.
Well, so let's just talk about the practical effects. This is a pretty big reversal after President Trump certified it twice and then says, no, we're not going to do that. What are the practical effects that this decision would have? In a lot of ways, obviously, the deal itself was very problematic. And now the question is, if the deal is actually broken, or what say those who are saying, well, this is a catastrophic move, the president has made a huge mistake, what are the dangers that might be there in terms of what Iran might do next?
Well, some of the dangers, we could say they start with the Trump administration itself, because this was a difficult decision for President Trump to make. In fact, some in his own administration have wanted him to preserve this nuclear deal, to just leave it as it is. I think even Rex Tillerson and H.R. McMaster and James Mattis, they all wanted President Trump to come up with something that doesn't disrupt the current nuclear deal. And what President Trump announced on Friday last week was essentially him finding middle ground, just trying to appease those who want to preserve the deal and also those who want the deal to be scrapped. It's really a middle ground. We can applaud President Trump for trying to stick to his campaign promises, but really, it's not enough. It's not enough. So that's going to create a lot of problems, not only for his administration, but just for the United States. It's going to further isolate the United States. In fact, that's what a lot of people have been saying, especially a lot of liberals in the U.S. Government who have been saying that, well, guess what? This is not going to isolate Iran. It's going to isolate the United States. A lot of people have been saying that the world's ability to negotiate with crazy people is going to be a lot limited. This is going to set a bad precedent. It's going to be difficult to negotiate with anyone who wants to pursue a nuclear deal. We've gone so far. We've come so far. Let's not disrupt that. Let's not mess that up.
There's just an enormous amount of stock being put in the ability of negotiations to resolve these problems when you're looking at so much evidence that a nation like Iran is essentially using negotiations as a ruse or a pretext for being able to continue the activities that it wants to behind the scenes, that it's given Iran a certain legitimacy in the eyes of the international community without really changing their goals, their ambitions at all. They continue their activities there at home. They're continuing their nuclear activities and missile cooperation with North Korea. It's remarkable just how much value and stock the diplomats and the politicians of the world are putting in these pieces of these words on paper, in flying in the face of all evidence to the contrary.
Iran signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty many years ago. I don't remember exactly when, but it signed that treaty saying that we're not going to proliferate nuclear weapons. But the reason why we have this nuclear deal is because it broke that. It broke that agreement. And yet somehow the world still thinks that Iran will not break this nuclear deal, when it will just based on history, and it will just based on what it's already doing right now. So it's just unbelievable. It's hard to believe the way the world reacts to this.
If somebody were interested in more information, what resources would you direct them to?
Our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, has just written a very powerful booklet. It's titled Nuclear Armageddon is at the Door. And it does talk about all these developments, these nuclear weapons, these weapons of mass destruction that are spreading all across the world. And it's one of the most urgent pieces of literature that we have. And our readers need to read that and understand what's coming and how God is going to solve it. Another booklet to request is The King of the South, the one that identifies Iran as that prophesied power that will trigger this crisis.
All right, we've been talking with trumpet writer Anthony Chibadarwe. He's working on an article about President Trump not certifying the Iran nuclear deal and the ramifications of that decision. You can watch for that article on thetrumpet.com. You can also get those booklets that he referenced. If you just go up to the literature tab at the top of thetrumpet.com, you can find those booklets under that tab. We appreciate your time, Anthony.
Good to be here.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Another stunning election result in Europe. These seem to be happening every month or two. This one in Austria. This past weekend, the party with the most votes was the Conservative People's Party. It was led by a 31-year-old political whiz kid named Sebastian Kurz. He's young and handsome. He represents a poke in the eye to the political elites in that country. He talks tough on immigration. Some are actually calling him the Austrian Trump, not the Austrian JFK, but the Austrian Trump. And on top of that, the far-right Freedom Party had its best showing in nearly 20 years. Fascinating developments here in another European nation. To talk about this, we have from our office in Britain, trumpet writer Richard Palmer. Hello.
Hello, good afternoon.
So talk more about Sebastian Kurz and what this young man represents.
Yeah, I think Kurz represents something very interesting. We've talked about the rise of strongmen across the world, and we've even had it on the cover of our trumpet magazine. Well, where are Europe's strongmen? Mm-hmm. Where are the men that can really lead Europe out of crises? And I think Kurz is one of these at least strong type men, but with a very European and a very different flavor to say Vladimir Putin or some of these other strong men that you see around the world, or even Donald Trump. And it's a very interesting combination that you have with Kurz. So he is, I think, in a lot of ways, he does fit that strongman mold in that when he took over the leadership of his party, he said, look, I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to take on this job unless you vote to give me what really is unprecedented power for a leader of an Austrian political party. And they voted to give him that. They were desperate. You know, his party was in free fall. Their vote was collapsing. And he was kind of their only hope. So they gave him that power. And then he used it. He dissolved the coalition that he was a junior partner in called Fresh Elections. He also almost single-handedly played a major role in solving the European migrant crisis. And Angela Merkel's deal with Turkey has gotten a lot of attention. But I think probably more significant is the deal negotiated by Sebastian Kurz as his role as foreign minister, which was his job before this election, where he went to he traveled around the Balkan states and to Romania, Bulgaria, and he negotiated a deal where all of these countries got together and said, we're closing our borders to migrants. If migrants make it to Greece, well, they make it to Greece, but we're not going to let them come north of Greece. They're going to be stuck in Greece. We're going to let Greece fill up with migrants. And it was him going around and orchestrating that deal that really helped put a stop to the migrant crisis, because migrants stopped wanting to come to Greece because Greece was just getting overwhelmed. I think even at one point, the German finance minister, Wolfgang Schäuble, Apparently he quipped to Kurtz, "Oh, has Merkel thanked you yet for fixing the migrant crisis?" Now that he's not on the greatest terms with Merkel, he was kind of being sarcastic. So you've got that strongman part of things. But then what I think is interesting is he also brings a lot of charisma to the role. He's been compared to Donald Trump. He's also been compared to Justin Trudeau.
Oh, yeah.
Which I think is a very interesting, you know, it's almost like, well, Donald Trump on politics, but Trudeau in terms of style.
Yes.
That's smooth, suave. You know, I saw him called a politician, a Ferrari among politicians. Uh-huh. Spiegel published an article this week and they talked about how they conducted this interview. I think he was flying economy class as Austria's foreign minister on a plane to the United Nations. You know, people just love that kind of thing in these days. And when politicians are seen as rich and corrupt, to have a young, normal, down-to-earth guy who's happy just to not even sit in business class, let alone fly on a government jet, but sit in economy class with everybody else, fly over, give a speech at the United Nations, that's a recipe for popularity.
Yeah, this deal that you say the party gave turned over more power to him. 31 years old, he's the youngest politician now in power in Europe, and I don't know, maybe in the world. Certainly, extremely young. But doesn't that reflect just how desperate voters are, and how desperate sort of the climate is? In addressing politics and basically undermining politics as usual.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And you do see a youngering age of politician. I mean, look at the leaders of the Dutch political parties. They haven't sorted out a government yet, but the main victors, you know, Mark Rutte, Geert Wilders, they're all younger. You saw that in France with Emmanuel Macron. I saw one article today. It was talking about the kind of the comeback of Zu Gutenberg, and it was also talking about Kurtz. It was a German article, and it says, are we longing for new, young, charismatic figures in politics? You know, do we want new faces? And I think that's a big part of it. I think, well, in some ways, there's two parts of it. I think there's a longing for charisma and inspiration that some of these young guys are able to bring, but I think just a longing for change as well.
Yeah.
And this is a trend that you see all across Europe. You know, Macron campaigned in the French election as the outsider. He started a new party. I mean, you had Melanie Phillips on this show, and she was talking about how, well, really, you know, he's a political insider, but he marketed himself as an outsider because that's what people want. They want someone new. And it's kind of the same with Kurtz. You know, he's been foreign minister for Austria for several years, but nevertheless, he still came along and marketed himself as an outsider. I think he even tried at one point to toyed with changing his party's name to try and drum up this appeal as an outsider. You've got the Czech election coming up next week, and the favorite to win that, Andrej Babis, he founded his political party in 2012. Now, again, he's got a longer track record in politics, but he's campaigning as a political outsider. And so all across Europe, you know, they're fed up of old way of doing things. The way to win is to come in from the outside, or to at least make it look like you're coming in from the outside.
I'd like to talk more, a little bit more about what's happening in the Czech Republic in light of everything else that we're talking about here, because there really does seem to be an interesting dichotomy between this sort of disdain for Donald Trump and this a certain using his playbook in order to win elections happening within some European countries. But to go back to Austria for a moment, Mr. Kurtz did not receive enough votes to rule outright. He's got to form a coalition. What are his options now?
Well, he's choosing between two options. And actually, this is kind of the interesting thing, is we don't know who came second in the election yet. Mm-hmm. At least earlier today when I checked, we didn't know. It's neck and neck, and it's neck and neck between the main left-wing party and really one of Europe's most far-right parties, the Freedom Party of Austria, a party that was founded by ex-SS, that's kind of a tongue twister, but you know, these ex-Nazi officers founded this party. And both of them got right around 25%. I think the last count I saw put the main left-wing party fractionally ahead. And so his options now are either he goes with this party with a coalition with the main left-wing party, and that's typical for Austria. They've spent, I think, most of their post-war years with a government that's a coalition between the main left-wing party and the main right-wing party. Certainly happens very often. The other option is what's slightly taboo, and to make this coalition with the far right party. Yeah. Now, he made it clear that this was an option for him. Very different from the German election, where all German politicians said, no, there's no way we're going to deal with the AfD.
Right.
When arguably the AfD is less right wing than the FPO, this right wing party in Austria.
Which is interesting, because these two parties are the AfD and this Freedom Party are, I guess, allies, or they're somewhat in the same mold. But this far right party in Austria actually outperformed the AfD, did it not?
It did, but I think they've got more history, the FPO, and perhaps even Austria. I think there's historical issues there where I think Austria did even less than Germany did to kind of confront their history with Nazis and to kind of own up or take responsibility or to have any process of doing that. And so they've, you know, historically, even going back for the last few decades, had a much stronger far-right political presence than Germany did. So the FPO, I mean, you're comparing an established party, a more established party with a far-right party that sprung up just within the last 5 years or so in Germany. Mm. So I think that's why the difference. But yes, they certainly outperformed them. If you remember last year, we talked a fair bit about how the FPO nearly won the presidency elections.
Yes.
In Austria, which was just stunning that you had this this far right group come that close to winning the presidency. Now, the Kurz's party has been in coalition with the FPO once before. They did that a while ago, and I think there was, you know, a bit of, well, you know, it was several years ago, and that caused big consternation at the time. The European Union talked about stripping them of their voting rights, stripping them off of their money. That they get back from Europe, really punishing them. And that was a big dramatic step at the time. Now it's kind of more normal for Austria. It's still kind of a bit taboo. A lot of leaders of that main right-wing party said they wouldn't do it again, but there's a little bit of a taboo there. And Europe has got so many right-wing parties kind of rising that they're not even worried, or it doesn't really seem even on their radar this time. So it also just shows how much Europe has changed.
That's really fascinating. I guess we'll just have to keep our eyes on that. Any sense of the timetable for when he would make a decision on how to compose his coalition?
Well, I think it'll be much quicker than Germany.
Sure.
Basically, I think he's deliberately not committed himself to either side, so he's got two good options and he can start a bidding war.
Yeah.
So I haven't seen too many indications on the timing, but I don't think it will be long and complicated. And I think the difference between the Austrian election and the German election in many ways is that in Germany, nobody wanted to talk about immigration. In Austria, you know, the far right party were complaining that Kurz was stealing all of their ideas and policies. And it seemed like the two parties were vying with each other to outdo each other in how much they were talking about immigration, about problems relating to Islam, this kind of thing. So there's much more of a unity of ideas there, even that you could see them uniting behind a common purpose much more quickly than Angela Merkel has got to get to grips with her parties in Germany.
Just quickly, I think it's interesting. There is some level of connection between Sebastian Kurz and the man that we talk so much about in Germany, Karl Theodor zu Guttenberg. Can you just talk about that briefly?
Yeah, so Kurz's party is kind of considered the sister party to the Christian Democratic Union, the Christian Social Union in Austria. They're pretty close. And then even zu Guttenberg and Kurz themselves are kind of said to be politically quite close. I've heard that they're friends. They've certainly met a few times, even over the summer. There was an important but closed-door meeting that the two of them both attended. I think they're both part of the European Council on Foreign Relations as well. So they do have a few ties and perhaps even a friendship there. And then there are certainly people that have compared the two of them. And Kurz has even been called Austria's zu Guttenberg. I mean, he seems to be picking up an impressive number of comparisons to foreign politicians.
Yeah.
But there's a similarity there in terms of even well, both style and substance, the charismatic approach and also the right but not far right politics.
Yeah. Well, I had wanted to talk about the trend more broadly in Europe, but in a sense, maybe we can transition into just putting this in prophetic context. We were talking yesterday just about this prophecy of Europe having 10 kings that all kind of come together in this coalition, but it definitely it uses that terminology, 10 kings, that there would be a number of prominent leaders within Europe who would align. And you do wonder, looking at this situation and you know, in a sense, maybe even the personal relationship between Kurz and Gutenberg underlines that possibility a little bit of maybe we're seeing the development of the specific individuals that are mentioned in that prophecy.
Yes, I think so. I mean, we're certainly seeing the overall trend. I mean, the Bible talks about Europe, we've said for years, whittling down to 10 nations, and you can see that in Revelation chapter 17. You can read about that in our free booklet, The Holy Roman Empire in Prophecy, and it goes into all of those, the background to all everything we're talking about now. But yeah, the Bible says 10 kings, and they're not democratic leaders, they're kings, and it's not 28 nations like we see in the European Union, it's 10. So that implies a certain, quite a lot of turmoil, of political uncertainty, of people becoming dissatisfied with the status quo. That's exactly what we saw in the Austrian election. You know, person portraying themselves as an outsider winning, the far right party getting 25% of the vote. Yeah, that's exactly the kind of turmoil and upheaval you would expect ahead of that kind of major change in Europe. And then you see the response to that. Okay, well, it's to elect someone like Kurz, a charismatic strongman. And you know, if he's not one of the 10, well, it's certainly following in that pattern. But yes, I think you could well be seeing him there, maybe someone like Viktor Orban in Hungary, but you see Hungary, Poland, probably even now the Czech Republic, all following in these similar patterns. And so, yes, maybe we're starting to see the rise of these particular leaders, but you're certainly seeing nations turn to strong leaders, to king-type leaders, exactly the way that we've been forecasting for years.
It really is a fascinating development. You alluded to it earlier on in the interview, and you see the rise of these strong men, particularly in Asia, and this impulse in dealing with the increased dangers and the threats in the modern world with voting populaces that say we really need strength in order to meet the threats. And so you see it in Asia, you see it in Russia and China and Japan and elsewhere, and you see it in the United States. That certainly was the impulse that seemed to propel Donald Trump into the presidency. And you really are seeing this in an interesting way playing out. It seems like it's in some ways it's more complicated. Like you said, it's in the European mold, and these individuals that are being elected, it seems like they reflect more of the dissatisfaction than they do at this point the real desire for that singular personality to kind of rule over everything. But you certainly see all of the conditions being put in place and the climate within Europe taking shape that will create the conditions that will propel this one man prophesied in the Bible to take over Europe. Gerald Fleury, our editor-in-chief, has written about that in a booklet, A Strong German Leader is Imminent. Bringing those prophecies of the Bible to bear on what's happening there today. Really interesting to watch this, and we'll have to keep our eyes on how the situation unfolds there in Austria. We've been talking with trumpet writer Richard Palmer about the elections this past weekend in Austria. We're actually working on an article that we'll be posting on thetrumpet.com on these elections. Richard, this is really fascinating to look at. We appreciate your insights.
Thanks for having me.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
It has been a rough time with natural disasters the last several weeks, hurricanes, floods, earthquakes hitting one on top of the other. And while many areas have experienced the deluge, California has been burning for over a week. A cluster of wildfires has consumed Northern California's wine country. They're the deadliest in California history, killing at least 41 people, destroying nearly 6,000 homes. To talk about this, we have trumpet writer Sam Livingston from Edstone. Hello, Sam.
Hi, good to be here.
So just give us the latest details of what's happening here.
Well, like you said there, 41 people killed. It's been the deadliest wildfire in California's history. Just over 5,700 buildings have been burned down, and it's really an unprecedented fire, and just the damage that it's wreaked in a very urban area of California. Like you said, it has gone through California's wine country, but it's also swept into the city of Santa Rosa and taken out hundreds of buildings, killed, like you said, there are 41 people. And this is just one, I think, right now of 8 or 9 fires, though, that are burning across California. So far, over 200,000 acres have been burned just north of that Santa Rosa area. So this is really a fire that's just historic for this state so far.
So 41 deaths, this is the deadliest fire in California's history. Why so many deaths? What is it that has made this so devastating?
There's a number of things that they were mentioning that with the intensity of this fire. I think the major aspect of this was how quickly it spread. California had the driest summer on record, particularly in that San Francisco area. They had the driest summer, the hottest summer. And then this is coming off of a very wet winter, so there was a lot of growth during the winter. And then here comes the summer. All of that dries out, just makes there's plenty of fuel for this fire to burn. And then coupling that with very high winds, they said in some areas it was upwards of 70-mile-an-hour winds. So they're just pushing this fire through the mountains and then into these urban areas, and people haven't had any time to escape. You really can't outrun it, something that's being blown that fast. And then the fire as well, with those high winds, it's jumping over barriers that firefighters used to rely on to contain fires, like a highway, for instance. The fire gets there and it's jumping over, you know, 6 lanes of concrete.
Wow.
Because the wind is just blowing that the flames over the top of it, and then it's just skipping across the city and into neighborhoods.
So how effective has the warning system been to prompt evacuations and to keep people out of harm's way?
Very ineffective. A few people or the emergency services sent text alerts to the people who were signed up to them. And then there's something called a ping alert, which is something that is sent out to all the cell phones in an area, warning them about the disaster, warning them to evacuate. That never went out. So there are a lot of questions as to why that didn't happen. I think the main concern was they didn't have much of a plan or a route for evacuations. What they were worried about was traffic just getting backed up and then people not being able to leave, period. So it was more or less, as you see the fire approaching, get out. But I don't think people really understood how quickly this fire was moving. I mean, people, when they saw it, you had 8 or 10 minutes to get out, and then your house was engulfed in flames.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's phenomenal. So looking at this more broadly, and maybe even in light of these other fires that you have going on in California, this is something that's been going on for a while. Just talk about the ripple effects within the economy, statewide, nationwide.
Obviously, the first thing that comes to mind is this is California's wine country in the Napa Valley area. They said that the fires didn't hit that as hard as you'd expect because they have just gotten over farming all of their grapes for this season and picking them. So there aren't a lot of grapes that are left on the vines. They're saying that the real impact of this is going to come next year when the next season, where you're going to have a lot of these vines absorbing a lot of that smoke and the dust from the fires. It's going to ruin a lot of the vineyards there. But they said a lot of the vineyards aren't being burnt because those plants are kept alive. They're very moist. There's a lot of water around those areas. Right now, the main grape that's being hit is for, I think it's Cabernet, and they're estimating about $175 million worth of damages just because of that one grape being affected. You really can't use it because of all the smoke that it's absorbing. They can mix it and salvage it with other things, but primarily you're seeing the wine industry getting hit hard. And then obviously just the housing destruction there and the economy being shut down in a pretty vital area of California. And then the repercussions move right down into San Francisco area, Silicon Valley. If you've seen the pictures, it's just almost this apocalyptic type haze over the entire city. It's filled with dust. It just is producing all sorts of problems when it comes to air traffic and things like that as well.
So we had an article on September. Well, Richard Palmer wrote an article just a little bit a few days ago. The September 13th article was a different one, but his article, Why Yet More Californian Wildfires, just talking about how bad this year has been and what a massive increase over previous years we've had just this year in California. Can you just put it in the context, in that context for us?
Yeah, I think I don't have the exact numbers, but what he was writing about is over just the amount of area that has been burned. I think it's 100,000 more acres than what California normally gets. They haven't gotten the rain that they normally receive. They said rain levels are down below the 25% below average. So you're really seeing this recipe for disaster, but there's not a clear explanation as to why now California has been in a huge drought the past 5 or 6 years. There's really not a lot that you can say about what is the timing of all of this. Why is it happening now, these fires all across the state? It's something that's been in the works for a long time, but as to pinpoint what would have triggered it now, there's really not a lot that they can say.
Well, we even broader context, that September 13th article that I referenced, America's Other Enormous Environmental Disaster of 2017, yeah. Wildfires, talks about this heat wave across the entire West Coast. You've had several fires burning for quite a long time in several states, millions of acres destroyed across the country. Put this in prophetic context for us, because obviously this is the angle that you're not going to get from any other news source that's reporting on this. But we're obviously locked in on the spiritual significance of these disasters that are plaguing the United States. Just talk about that.
Right. I think this has been, especially the last 2 or 3 months, when you look at the hurricanes down in the Gulf and around Houston and then in the Caribbean, you see parts of the country that are just intense rain, record rains, powerful hurricanes. And then the other half of the country, you are experiencing drought and you're experiencing fires. And we've written extensively about that. You can read our booklet, Why Natural Disasters, for a thorough explanation on that. But I think this is really, we're seeing this being powerfully illustrated in the United States with record rain in Houston and the most expensive natural disaster over there. And now we're having the deadliest fires in another part of the country. In Amos 4, it talks about how God brings – he causes the rain to fall on one city, but then he withholds it from another. So we're really getting that literally in California, comparing that with Houston and then in Florida with the hurricanes. The last 2 or 3 months, it's been record disasters. I think – probably one of the most dramatic things just looking at this fire in California is the imagery of it. When the Bible talks about in the book of Joel, gardens being before you, but then desolation, destruction behind you. When you look at these images, I can't remember you know, offhand, any fire sweeping through a city like this, and it's melting homes and it's melting cars and the steel that is building these cars, and it's apocalyptic. And that is, I mean, even in Isaiah, God talks about your cities are burned with fire, and, you know, God is controlling this. But these scenes, it's really making that imagery real about what is coming.
Yeah, one verse that we actually referenced in one of our articles on the subject that stood out to me is Isaiah 29 and verse 6. It says, "You shall be punished of the Lord of hosts with thunder and with earthquake and great noise, with storm and tempest and the flame of devouring fire." It's quite a comprehensive list in that verse. And we've seen all of that just within the last couple of months within the United States. But the point being that it is actually punishment, that it's not happenstance, and it's not because of carbon emissions or global warming or anything of the sort. It's actually God visiting us or punishing us for sin and trying to drive people to repentance. And I guess the thing about that is, and there is a lot more information about that and a lot more scriptures to look at in that Why Natural Disasters booklet, but you just don't see too many people responding with that kind of response. There's not the repentance that you would hope. People tend to just have more of a let's pick ourselves up by our bootstraps, let's rebuild, let's go about our business as quickly as we possibly can, which is somewhat disheartening.
Yeah, I've read a lot of articles that are talking exactly about that. It's climate change, and we're responsible. And, you know, they get into all the details of, well, how do we build cities and our farming techniques? And, I mean, how many deadly disasters have to happen, and, you know, how many record-breaking disasters have to happen in a 2 or 3 month span before people start to ask, well, why? Why now? I mean, if climate change has been happening for all these years, why 2017? And, you know, it's incredible to see the amount of detail that people will go into, explain it away, and then just, like you say, rebuild and move on. But California in particular just keeps getting battered. I think, you know, it's just the start of this year where we're talking about intense flooding in the same area of California, record rain, and now that's all being cleared out by fire. And how much longer do people have to go? Does this have to go on before people ask why?
Yeah. There is a reference also within Richard Palmer's article, Why Yet More Californian Wildfires, where he links to an article by Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry that specifically talks about the state of California and how it's been kind of uniquely singled out for some of the worst disasters, it seems, over the past couple of decades. And the state is really hurting in a lot of ways, and he explains a spiritual reason for that that is important to note within this context. But anything else that you might send people to in terms of if they were interested in more information on the spiritual significance of what's happening here?
Well, of course, the main booklet there being Why Natural Disasters, but then also, as you just mentioned there, Mr. Gerald Flurry's article is California Under a Curse. He wrote that in 2003. I think it was a rewrite from something earlier in the 90s. But that article, you know, though it's over 10 or 15 years old, is pretty much as up to date as you're going to get as to why these disasters keep happening in California, from earthquakes to flooding to wildfires. Why this state is getting battered. And you can find that on the website, Is California Under a Curse, just in the search box there at the top.
We've been talking with trumpet writer Sam Livingston. He's working on another article about what's happening here in California. You can watch for that on thetrumpet.com. Sam, we do appreciate you filling us in. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me.
It's time for today's Last Word.
Carmen Gallo is a communication coach. He has studied and evaluated the most popular TED Talks. These are videos with speakers from all over the world giving inspirational and educational talks on a variety of subjects. And some of these videos have been viewed millions of times. The most popular of them have been viewed over 10 million times. So there's obviously something really working in these talks. And Carmen Gallo wrote a book called Talk Like TED, The 9 Public Speaking Secrets of the World's Top Minds. And he divided his book into 3 parts. These are 3 qualities that are common to all of the most engaging presentations. The first is that they are emotional. The second, that they're novel. They teach something new. And the third is that they're memorable. That first section on emotion, and the first chapter of that section, the very first thing that this man covers is about passion. He says, science shows that passion is contagious, literally. You cannot inspire others unless you are inspired yourself. You stand a much greater chance of persuading and inspiring your listeners if you express an enthusiastic, passionate, and meaningful connection to your topic. Now, what works for public speaking actually works for life. In order to really succeed at something, in order to really accomplish something important, you need passion for it. If you're not passionate about it, you just won't accomplish much success at that thing. I want to give you 3 reasons why passion is so important, why it's something that you should seek to build more of in your life. The first is that passion inspires action. Herbert W. Armstrong talked about emotion as being an impulse toward an action. We are, according to Scripture, we are to be doers of the word. It's one thing to learn about something or maybe get an idea that, yeah, I should be doing that. It's another thing to actually follow through and take that action. Generally, if you don't feel it, you probably won't do it. You just don't do things that you don't want to do, at least not for very long. So passion inspires the action that you need to take in your life. Ralph Waldo Emerson said, "Nothing great has ever been achieved without enthusiasm." The second reason why we need to build passion is that passion surmounts obstacles. Whenever you're trying to do something important, there are always things that get in the way, and it is easy to kill motivation if that motivation is weak. But if you're passionate about something, that can really help you break through those obstacles. I read a book about George Lucas and the making of the movie Star Wars back in the 1970s. And this book just detailed all of the setbacks and the problems that he experienced in trying to get this movie made. There were so many things about it that were so unusual, and there were a lot of people that really didn't believe that this was going to be successful at all. But Mr. Lucas had a vision, and he kept pressing, and he kept navigating ways around all of these obstacles. He had impressive determination because he was so passionate about getting this movie made. And it was because of that passion that he was able to surmount those obstacles and get so many people on board. It ended up being one of the most successful movies in history. It never would have happened without the passion that surmounts obstacles. The third reason why passion is so important is that passion is contagious. You know, it's very difficult to get other people to make changes in their lives. It's very difficult to convince people to actually follow through and take action, even if they believe that it's the right thing to do. Well, passion is a crucial ingredient to even have a shot at helping someone to change. If you're a teacher, if you are a parent, you're trying to inspire someone to make changes in their lives, you have to be passionate if you have a shot at really inspiring other people. Baldwin said, "Fires cannot be made with dead embers, nor can enthusiasm be stirred by spiritless men." We need to have passion if we're going to really help other people. Now, when passion is directed at the right things, it is a very godly virtue, and it matters to all of us if we're going to be able to accomplish much of anything. It is a great virtue. Isaiah 9 and verse 7 talks about God in this way: of the increase of his government and peace, there shall be no end upon the throne of David and upon his kingdom, to order it and to establish it with judgment and with justice from henceforth, even forever. The zeal of the Eternal of Hosts will perform this. This is talking about the zeal of the Eternal, the passion of God that leads to him getting results, establishing peace and order and judgment and justice, changing lives. God is zealous. God is passionate. We need to build that zeal and that passion in our lives. That will inspire action. It will surmount obstacles, and it will spread to others, giving it a multiplying effect that can really accomplish great things. I'm Joel Hilliker, and we're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. You can send comments on the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests on today's program, Anthony Chabadirwe, Richard Palmer, and Sam Livingston. Thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with this thought from Henry David Thoreau: books are the carriers of civilization. Without books, history is silent, literature dumb, science crippled, thought and speculation at a standstill. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.